This week marks the 45th anniversary of Germany's unconditional surrender to the Allies. In Moscow, the event was marked by parades, while in Bonn, talks are underway among the Allied countries on how to put Germany back together again. After the Berlin Wall came down, one of the first official acts taken by the new East German government was to apologize for its part in the Holocaust. This was the first time East Germany took responsibility for its role. The way different countries remember or distort the Holocaust is the focus of a new book by journalist Judith Miller. It's called One by One by One. In researching the book, Miller visited West Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, France, the Soviet Union, and she toured the United States. I asked her first about West Germany.
The West Germans, I think, have done more to come to grips with the past than just about any other European country that I visited and worked in. And they did that before we start pinning any medals on them, because they absolutely had to do it. No one would let them back into civilized company if they did not. And as a result, they have made extraordinary efforts to let the world know that they have remembered. And they do remember. They've paid almost $40 billion in reparations to survivors and to Israel. And the other thing that really struck me was West Germans have hundreds and hundreds of reunions and commemorations. And I didn't find this in any other European country. And I went back to one of those reunions with 300 Jews from all over the world and watched them confront and reacquaint themselves with people who had helped and people who had not helped, and with the places they had grown up and the people they had known. And it was an incredibly moving experience.
But you think that there's a lot of recent revisionism in West Germany?
Yes, as there is everywhere. Now, when I talk about revisionism, I'm not talking about those people who deny that the Holocaust took place. But the more subtle forms of revisionism are really everywhere and very disturbing. For example, one thing that one can begin to hear a lot of now in Germany is, why is it only the Jewish suffering that counts? What about us? We suffered too. We lost 1 million people on the Eastern Front when the Russians invaded. Why is it that our suffering and the bombing of Dresden and Hamburg, the firebombings, all of this doesn't count? Now, it's not that it doesn't count. It's that their suffering must be put into perspective. They started the war. They were responsible for it. Everything that happened happened to them because they began World War II. And it's the second part of that formulation that one hears less and less in modern Germany.
But don't you think there is some truth in the fact that in most wars, there are victims on both sides, that the people of both countries end up becoming victims?
Innocent people in all countries suffered because of the war. But we must always tell ourselves, how did this war and this suffering begin? You know, we are all guilty here, all of us, even the United States, Americans, by, if not commission, of omission. The question is not, what did they do? But the question should be, what did we fail to do to stop it? And that's where one can really, truly begin to be somewhat depressed and pessimistic about human nature.
In your book about how people remember the Holocaust, one of the countries you look at is the United States, in which there's really been a proliferation of Holocaust remembrance projects. You've tallied up 98 Holocaust-related institutions, 19 museums, 48 resource centers, 34 archival facilities, 12 memorials, etc. What does it say to you that there are so many Holocaust remembrances in the United States?
You know, after Israel, the largest number of survivors came here, and they found shelter, not during the Holocaust largely, but after it, here. And they prospered, and they are now aging, and they now feel very, very strongly that they want non-Jewish Americans to remember this experience. And they, the Jewish Americans, have taken the lead in these projects, in almost all of them. And I think that it speaks well of our culture that we are empathetic enough to open our hearts and to build these buildings and to make a statement that, yes, in fact, we do care as a culture, as a nation, as a people, about part of our people's suffering. You know, very few European countries would do that. We, the Americans, really are different in that respect.
But there is some concern in the American Jewish community that Jews are dwelling too much on the Holocaust. What are their concerns?
There is a concern that the Holocaust is becoming, in their words, an obsession, that young Jews only seem to know about the Holocaust. They don't know about the richness of Jewish life in Europe, about the traditions, even about the religion itself. And they find that dangerous, both for the kind of soul and sanity of American Jewry. And I think that is a legitimate concern. And the second thing they fear is that these institutions, these museums that are being built, will become somehow vulgarized, and that the Holocaust through them will become vulgarized. And that's a great danger. I think they're right about that.
Will you describe the plans for something that will be called the Museum of Tolerance? And this is a Holocaust museum that has become fairly controversial. What's controversial about the plans for this museum?
Well, this one is being built in Los Angeles. Its operator, the person who's conceived it, is named Rabbi Marvin Heyer. And many, many Jews have been critical of Rabbi Heyer because they say that he is turning the Holocaust, his museum, into kind of a sound and light show. It's become Disneyland West. The museum will rely heavily on high technology. There will be blackened screen, and you will find yourself standing in front of the gates of Auschwitz with booming recorders in back of you, recreating the what it must have been like. Well, you know, a lot of people just find that very distasteful.
Do you think that there is a form of remembering that cheapens the past?
I think that form of remembrance certainly threatens to cross the line into vulgarity. I think that also scaring people into remembering, which is another technique that the Seemann Wiesenthal Center has used, is not the right approach. You know, he sends out massive mailings to people. His organization, the Seemann Wiesenthal Center, is one of the fastest growing Jewish organizations. And he basically, his message is, you've got to support my museum or they, the Gentiles, are going to do it to us again. I think we have to be careful about scaring people into remembering because you're not going to get the kind of commemoration that we want, which is thoughtful and which is balanced, which is historically accurate. I think you'll just get a lot of scared people giving money to the center.
I think it's fair to say that the type of remembering that you found yourself most moved by were the documented stories of survivors, stories documented on audio tape or videotape.
Absolutely. There are many of these projects now all over the country, and one that's particularly impressive is being done at Yale University, in which people who are survivors, Jews and non-Jews, by the way, and people who saw something that related to that period came to Yale, and they told their stories, their very personal individual stories. And one story that impressed me enormously was a priest from Poland who had lived near a railroad station in which Jews were being transported to concentration camps. And night after night, he would hear the crying from these cars. And he was then not a priest, just a boy. But one day he got the courage to stick his head through the wooden slots of the fence that had been built to prevent Poles from knowing what was going on. And he saw this horrible scene in which a man who was pleading for a glass of water, a cup of water, with a Gestapo guard was beaten to death just in front of his eyes. He saw it. And he said, "And what did I do? What did I do?" He said, "I ran away. I did nothing. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't say anything. I was horrified and I was terrified and I was unprepared." And I understood from what he had said that that experience had prompted him to become a priest and that he was wrestling with that experience to this day. Now, that kind of personal recounting of history, personal history, although it's not history and shouldn't be confused with it, helps us as individuals understand what people suffered, what it meant, and what happened, and how it changed people and their lives forever.
Have you found yourself wondering how this question of how we remember the Holocaust will be handled a few years from now when most of the survivors and most of the perpetrators have died out.
That's really why I wrote the book, because I wanted to look at the way each different country that I visited, my own country, the Soviet Union, and these four European countries, the way they were distorting or remembering or reshaping or politically manipulating the memory of the past. And even Waldheim, the Waldheim controversy in Austria, it was a great educational experience for the people in Europe. My Lord, this man who was now president of Austria had had this terrible Nazi past that he'd lied about. But when he's gone, there will be no more Waldheims and no more shocks to the collective system of memory in that sense. So we have to rely on other ways of remembering, and that's why these museums are so important. That's why commemorations are so important. That's why history and videotape and anything that can personalize the memory of this event for people for whom it will soon be truly history, that's why that matters, and that's why I wanted to look at it.
Well, Judith Miller, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Judith Miller is an editor at the New York Times and the author of One by One by One, Facing the Holocaust. It's published by Simon & Schuster.